Hi, I'm Frank Ferris, one of the principals of the Palliative Care Interdisciplinary Curriculum. I want to personally thank you for joining us for this module in our series on care delivery.
I'm Jillian Gustin from The Ohio State University, and we're going to spend about the next 45 minutes talking about introduction to patient assessment. And our objectives for today are much of what we just talked about. What is suffering? And as we think about what is suffering, how do we assess for it so that we can actually do something about it? Okay. How's that? I just want to take everyone's pulse for a moment because I don't know about you, but I was incredibly moved by that session we just had. Any things that people want to share about your reactions to it as you think about patient assessment?
Luke and I were just talking about Paul, and he said that he definitely would not want to have any palliation done before that turning point.
Mm-hmm.
So we were wondering how that would be handled by somebody that was approaching the family with the suggestion that we get it started sooner.
Yeah. So really thinking about when's the right timing and how do you assess for that? How do you work with patients and their families to figure out when do we bring this thing up called palliation and when do we offer the services that we can provide? And there were some comments about shouldn't we be providing it on day one? I'd argue yes and no, and that's partly what we're going to talk about. How do you assess for that? When is the right time? Other thoughts that people had? Okay.
I just think it's really hard not to project his story onto our story, because we all have spouses, some of us have kids, we all have loved family members. And you hear his story and you start to project on your own life, which is not necessarily fair to Marin's story or ourselves.
Yeah, I think that's a huge point, right? So that was his story and it was only his family's experience. In fact, just his. Because if Marin was here, she might have told it slightly differently. If we talked to the kids, they might tell it slightly differently. So always thinking about, as we start to consider how do we assess, we have to be really careful that we're very focused on that person's story. And so we'll talk a little bit about how to do that. You'll hear me say over and over, for me, we all know what stories get us, right? So for me, my Achilles heel is women with young kids, right? It is me in that bed. And it is very hard not to project what that's like. So keeping that in mind, what are the things that really touch you and being aware of that as you're moving forward with patient assessment? Okay. So, what is suffering? What do you think?
Pain.
Pain, so it can be physical.
Loss.
Loss, so it can be a sense of grieving, bereavement.
A sense of unknown of
how to get yourself better, dealing with the uncertainty. For some folks, that is true suffering, the not knowing. Any other thoughts?
Worry about your family at this time.
So the worry that you have about the people that you love. So it's not just about you as the patient. It's, oh my goodness, what am I doing to my kids, to my spouse, to my partner? Okay. So there was a wonderful article in the New England Journal in 1982 by a gentleman called Eric Castle, and I would suggest everyone read it, called The Nature of Suffering and the Goals of Medicine. And one of the things he talked about is suffering is really a threat to our intactness, our integrity, our sense of self. And all the things that you just described are part of that. Cicely Saunders, who Dr. Ferris referenced earlier, is another sort of luminary in our field and talked a lot about suffering as total pain. So not just the physical pain, which I think for doctors and nurse practitioners, that's the easy part because you can see it. But the other parts of pain, the existential, the spiritual, the psychosocial, the thinking about your families, all the things that go into how we experience pain. So our job, for those of you who are starting fellowship or those of you who are going right into practice, our job really as palliative care clinicians is to do our best to address suffering. We can't always reduce it. We can't always get rid of it. But we want to be able to address it. So one of the things Dr. Ferris taught me, we're always learning, is the phrase, so as doctors and nurse practitioners, our job has always been to add days to life. And now part of our job is also to add life to days. And I think we had a lovely demonstration of that today, that those 20 months was about adding days to life, and really those last 3 months was adding life to days. Okay. So, interestingly, I think there's a huge shift in the world, not even just in the United States, but in the world, that the relief of suffering is becoming a human right. So the World Health Organization talks about this. We are increasingly seeing legislation across the world saying this should be international law. This should be part of how we care for patients with advanced disease, particularly around cancer is where we're seeing it most. It gets complex when we talk about suffering as a human right, particularly in the PEDS world. And it's great to have PEDS folks with us because we're not just talking about a patient. We're talking about a patient who often doesn't have a lot of autonomy. And parents are very much a part of that process. And so trying to think about what is suffering, who is suffering, and how do we address that suffering can get really complicated, whether it's with kids or with elderly who are demented, folks who can't speak for themselves. And I've told Lisa to just jump in at any moment if she has things to add, so please feel free.
I think the only thing that I would add to that is part of your job, be it an elderly person, a neonate, thinking through all these things about how you as a practitioner will try to navigate through one person's suffering to get to another person's suffering, and who at what moment during your journey gets to trump the other person, and then often in the midst of that, your own suffering gets mixed in the middle of that.
Yeah. Very layered. Very, very layered, that we will be unpacking those layers. So I want you all to imagine, this is hard to do, for some of you, maybe you've had a personal experience, it'll be a little easier. I want you to imagine you're a patient, okay? You're a patient in the hospital, and you are being discharged from the hospital to hospice, okay? So just take a moment and imagine that. So you are the patient. This is a tree trunk. Hard to tell, but it is a tree trunk. What are the things, what are the branches of this tree? What are the things that you are worrying about, that you think about in terms of your own suffering as that patient going from the hospital to hospice? What's going on in your mind? What, and I'll just have you call it out and I'll repeat it for...
What is death going to be like?
Okay.
Who will take care of my family?
Okay.
If I will die soon.
You will die soon. So how long?
It will be painful.
Is there going to be pain?
Where am I going?
Where am I going? Yeah, because most people haven't visited a place like Kobacker before if they're going to an inpatient unit. What else are you thinking about?
Why is this happening?
The why. Why me?
What are all the different things that will happen to my body?
What will happen to me? So not just about the pain part, but some of the other pieces. What actually physically is going to happen?
How will you be remembered?
So how will I be remembered? How about those goodbyes? Will there be time? Will I see the people I want to see?
How much will this cost?
Money. Money, sadly, is a big one.
We live religion or no religion, or what's going to happen after you die?
So thinking about not just sort of what's going to happen after I die, but how does that relate to my relationship with God? Anything else? It's a pretty good list. It's a lot of branches. How's my family going to deal? Okay. So now, switch gears. Okay, so this time, it's your partner, it's your spouse. They're the ones who are being discharged from the hospital to home. So this is your loved one. You're now the loved one. However you want to define that. And the patient is going to your home with hospice. What are you thinking about?
How are we going to take care of them?
Okay.
Oh, my identity change after they're gone.
Who am I when they're gone? How much time? So kind of similar from a little bit of a different perspective. How am I going to do this? Do I have time to do this?
I don't want to see them be uncomfortable.
Okay. How will I watch them suffer? How will I do if I watch them suffer? Cost.
And right below that branch, will their death look like?
So for the patient, it was what is death like, and for them is what is it going to look like? Anything else?
Can I take care of them in the home?
Can I do this? Can I do this? Do I have the skills? Do I have the time? Someone brought up.
Is there really no treatment left?
No more treatment? So just trying to wrap your head around where they're at, where the disease is at.
How will I know when to call for help?
When do I call for help? Great. Okay. Okay. Do you want to do the other two?
Okay. You're all getting nervous because you know it's Pete's time.
I'm going to have to hold this up so you can hear.
Okay. So now, particularly difficult, hopefully none of you have been through this experience. Imagine you're the parent of a child, and today's the day you're taking your child home from the hospital to die at home. What are you thinking? Okay, siblings, how to talk. How do I tell them? Right?
How do I tell my child?
How do I tell my child they're going to die? It's very hard to write sideways on this. Tell my child he will die. So justice, the unnaturalness of it all. I'm going to say not natural.
not fair. How do I go on?
How do I stay strong for my child?
Is it fair to say, can I do this? Or do you want strength in itself?
Strength.
Okay, let's do it. Okay. All right. Last color.
Can you see? I don't know if we can see the orange. Let's see.
I know. That's what I was wondering too. That's why I didn't pull it. Especially, can we compare it to the?
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Last one. Last one to imagine. You are the physician of a terminally ill patient in the hospital as the palliative care consultant. What are you thinking about for yourself? Making the right choices.
That's important to them.
What's important to them? Okay. Very fluffy tree. Okay. What will my relationship be like after they go to hospice? What will happen to my relationship? Okay. What am I missing? Okay.
What do you think about our tree?
A lot of question marks.
It's complicated. And just looking at the colors, no matter whatever perspective you're taking, it's very different than the other person. So whether you're the physician, the parent, the patient, the partner, what you're worried about, how you're defining suffering is very, very different. The hope is this illustrates that, as you were saying, Julia, we can't project what we think. As doctors, we can't say, or nurse practitioners, this is what you should be thinking about, because maybe they're not. So we have to assess for it. We have to ask the questions to make sure that we know for that patient and that family, what does suffering mean to them? Make sense? Okay. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about patient assessment. So how do we actually do this? And here's the funny thing is everybody in here is seasoned enough that you have done a lot of patient assessments in your day, right? So this is not rocket science. You know generally how to do this. And all we're doing is tweaking it and helping you think more broadly about this, that it's not just your typical HPI and review of systems. We need to think more broadly about what actually are we assessing for as we're thinking about our patients who are facing very serious or advanced illness. And we can't alleviate suffering unless we assess for it, right? Not going to get anywhere unless we know what we're trying to achieve. So Frank talked a little bit about this earlier, and I think our gentleman who told us his case also talked about this, that it's not just about the patient. So if you just focused on the patient, you'd only get that one sliver. That was the black. And what we realize is that our patients live in a context, whether it's their family, their community, the medical community. And so we always have to keep all of these things in mind, that they intersect so that we can do a better job of assessment. So these are the hospice and palliative medicine domains. So no matter where you go in the country, if you're practicing palliative medicine, you will see these. They come out of the National Consensus Project, which was in 2004, I think, and then the National Quality Forum. And they developed these to say, this is what we should be doing when we're taking care of patients. I will say, having said that, I often have these and I can't quite remember what they mean, and they just don't resonate with me in the same way that what I'm about to show you does. So we have our own revised version to help you, and that's what you saw earlier, and you have it in front of you. So what we've done is said, okay, let's dig deeper, let's drill down and think about what are these domains and what are the pieces that are in each of these domains. And for the rest of the time, we're just going to kind of walk through them and start to explore what they are. For a good palliative care consult, no matter whether you're in peds or the adult world, you need to be hitting most of these. Maybe not in the first visit, because that could be a really long H&P. But at some point in your interactions with that patient and their family, you need to hit most of these. So patient and family, hopefully this is fairly self-explanatory. You want to think about who the patient is, what their family system is. You want to think about demographics, their culture. I think in the PEDS world, clearly developmental stage is important. You know, how you would work with an infant and their parents is very different than how you would work with a teenager and their parents. So thinking about that. And then health literacy. And I just want to give you a quick example from being on call yesterday. So I got a consult on a young gentleman, he was about 32, who has pretty advanced heart failure. And he was at an outside hospital, got put on Milrinone, is now inotrope dependent, and somehow ended up at the Ross. And they asked for a palliative care consult because they were trying to figure out where do they go from here. And one of the things that came up is that they had talked to this gentleman about his healthcare power of attorney multiple times, and he just wasn't filling out the sheet. And when you talk to him, he says, yes, I'm married, but I hate my ex-wife, and I want nothing to do with her, and she should be not involved in any part of my care. And when you ask, he says, I want my sister as my healthcare power of attorney. So I heard this whole story, and I'm thinking, why in the world is this not done? Right? I worry about heart failure patients. Do you remember that graph? Boom, they can just plummet quickly, and we needed to get this done. So the social worker had been in there, the other team had been in there. So I go in, and I know this is going on, and I just ask the question. So I see the form, sir, beside your bed. Tell me, what's making it hard to fill it out? Any idea what the answer was?
Can't read or write.
Pretty simple. But no one had asked the question. So making sure you're thinking about some of those issues too, as you're thinking about who is the patient and who is the family. Capacity for medical decision making. So one of the other pieces that's important is as you're trying to figure out what does suffering mean to this patient and to this family, and can they be a part of decision making as we move forward, we need to assess for it. So this is typically what you learn, and when you do your ethics curriculum with Dr. Nash, he'll go over this as well. You need to be able to communicate a choice. So the patient needs to be able to say, I understand what my choices are. I understand all the information that's been given to me, and I can actually speak it back to you. I appreciate the situation. I know its consequences. I know if I go this way, what will happen, and if I go this way, what will happen. And I can reason through with you the treatment options and why I'm choosing what I'm choosing. So why might this be hard for some of our patients? Why might we question their capacity?
It may not make sense to us.
So we might not really understand what's going on. So we see a lot of patients where I don't know, I'm not really sure about what the treatment options are and how to make it make sense to them. Why else?
They're intubated and physically are unable to speak.
If they can't speak, if they're sedated, intubated, delirious.
There's a language barrier, even.
Language barrier.
Dementia.
The PEDS world. Okay. Is there anything in particular about pediatrics that you think makes this complicated?
Shared decision making.
Yeah, so tell me a little bit more about that. Because you live more in the PEDS world than I do.
There's a lot of input. And then you're going through parents as opposed to single decision makers.
Yeah.
More so than just the developmental age and consent.
Yeah. So it's complicated. There's a lot of players. And you want to keep the patient in the center, but in the PEDS world, depending on their developmental stage, it can be very hard to do that. I can speak as a parent. If I had to do some serious shared decision making with my 14-year-old, it would be difficult because he has some autonomy. He should be able to make some choices, but I'm still his mother, right? I'm going to hold on to that as long as I can. Okay. And then why do physicians often question capacity beyond just some of those either developmental stage or illnesses where that people can't actually make decisions? What's hard about it for us?
You already think we know the answer.
We think we know the answer. What else?
Maybe we think we know what's going to happen to them better than what they could predict because we've seen it before.
Yeah, so we have an attending that works with us who talks about, we've seen this movie about 100 times over. But our patients and families, it's the first time they've watched it. And we really want to tell them the ending, but they don't want to know. The other piece is often we think our patients make really bad decisions, right? So again, I had a patient yesterday. It was a very busy day on July 4th. A young gentleman with advanced GBM, leptomeningeal involvement, who was intubated, not sedated because he was obtunded, in the ICU. And neuro-onc, neurosurge, everybody had been in that room talking to the aunt, who's the surrogate decision maker, and saying, he is dying. There's nothing more we can do. After lengthy discussions, they believed that he said, no matter what, keep going. And we tried to reframe it, support, and they just truly believe that taking that ventilator away was tantamount to killing him. They wanted a trach. Do any of you think that's a good idea to trach this gentleman? Maybe not for the patient. How about for the aunt? Might be the right thing to do. But as a physician, it's really hard to offer that because it feels wrong. So we often have a hard time when our patients and families make decisions that we disagree with, which is why keep calm and let it go. This is for our Disney princess here.
I love that song.
So hopefully one of the things you'll hear over and over from us is we can only do our very best. How patients and families experience illness and suffering is their own. And we cannot be connected to the outcome. Sometimes the outcomes are not what we would expect. The ending is not the way we thought it was going to be in the movie, other than they die. We just got to let it go. And it's okay. It's okay for them to make choices that we don't always agree with. Is there anything from the PEDS side to add to that?
I'm becoming increasingly convinced in at least the PEDS world, and I should say for patients with chronic diseases. So you'll hear me talk a lot during your month with us, or more than 1 month if you're so unfortunate, that we create a culture when you have cystic fibrosis, right? So you are a child who becomes an adult who has fought for every breath, literally fought for every breath they've ever been allowed to have. Oncology has a different environment. Congenital heart disease that you guys then all inherit as adult, they all have personalities to it, right? One of the things I've had to learn over my arc of my career is, as much as I would like to define a good death, it's kind of the holy grail, and there's more than one, there's one more than one vision of that. And to the point of letting it go, barring it being egregious decision making on behalf of a child, or, you know, something that violates a law or an ethics, I think you have to learn this year how to start becoming comfortable with everybody else being allowed to define a good death, and then you just hopefully having the optimism to learn from it and maybe portray it to the next family you meet with cystic fibrosis. Because there's not a single cystic fibrosis patient who goes out nicely. Not one.
At least in our perspective, right?
True. Mm-hmm.
Maybe in their perspective it was okay to fight for that very last breath to the very, very end. And that's partly what you're assessing for. Does this all make sense? So you're going to hear us say this a lot. Keep calm and let it go. It's not that easy to do. We are, most of us, type A personalities, so this is hard. Okay, so let's walk through your little boxes that you have on your domains, and we're going to start with disease management. And particularly when you're doing the initial palliative care consults, this is incredibly important. You need to understand the primary diagnosis and the prognosis. And if you don't start talking to patients and families. Do your homework. So I know in my world, in the James, I'm going to be honest, it is really hard to stay up to date with all of the new cancer treatments out there and how it has changed the trajectory of these illnesses. And so if I don't know, I'm not going to speak about it. I will hold off and say, let me find out. And I will talk to their primary oncologists and say, help me understand. Educate me. I'm always learning. Okay? So that is very, very important to think about primary diagnosis and prognosis. And then, of course, how do the comorbidities weigh into all of this? So for me, who spends most of my time in the ICU, there's a lot of things going on that we're trying to pay attention to. It's not just the cancer. If it was just the, so often we get these BMT patients who have just crashed and burned. By the time they get to the ICU, it's really not about the cancer anymore. It's about the infection. It's they've got ARDS. What is the natural trajectory of those illnesses? Okay. Then general symptom management tool. So I gave you a little packet that's just for you to kind of look at your leisure, and we'll put it in our Dropbox as well. We have some general assessment tools. The two big ones that you'll see out in the world is the Memorial Symptom Assessment Scale and the ESAS, or the Edmonton Symptom Assessment Scale. Both have been validated. The Memorial one is rarely used in clinical practice, but you should know it because it's often used in research, and it's often used in a revised version in the PEDS world.
I would say not often used, but technically exists, and it's been validated. The other two have not been validated in pediatrics.
So ESAS has not been used in pediatrics. Often you'll see the ESAS symptom assessment scale kind of integrated into people's notes. We do have that at OSU. And then, at least at OSU, we have the James Supportive Care Screening. It's a quick assessment that we do to try and figure out what kinds of resources our patients need while they're in the hospital. So just there for you to look at. We then have some specific assessment tools, and there's many others out there. I just picked a few as examples. So a delirium screen, we're going to learn a lot more about delirium on Friday, but to know that there is something called the confusion assessment method. There's an ICU version of it. It's something that people often use. It's kind of a quick and dirty way to screen for delirium. And then we have a bunch of functional assessment tools. The Karnofsky, the ECOG, and the Palliative Performance Scale. And you have all of those as well. I think a few key points that I just want to point out before we move on is the Karnofsky is purely function. The Palliative Performance Scale includes the Karnofsky in it. So it actually can be a very effective way to kind of think about where is someone functionally, and then it often has been associated with prognosis as well. And we'll talk about that in a future lecture. And then ECOG, so anyone who's in the ONC world, no matter what hospital system you're in, uses ECOG. And it's a way to assess functional status. And in the adult world, it's often used to make decisions around treatment. So thinking about, are you in bed less than 50% of the time or more than 50% of the time, often is a cutoff that's used to decide whether you're going to get more chemotherapy or not. And as far as I know,
for pediatrics, the CAM ICU does have a PEDS variant that's validated that you can use even in neonates technically. But we technically, and we'll talk about more during the delirium one, most hospitals are moving towards the Cornell assessment pediatric delirium or the CAPD. So we'll talk more about that. And it's also validated. And that's what we're using at Nationwide. You'll theoretically hear the oncologist talking about the Karnofsky and the ECOG, but welcome to PEDS. They just ignore it and move on. The PPS is not validated in PEDS, and the substance abuse screening, unfortunately, no one has been able to figure out truly how to validate a scale that would put a child at risk for opioid use or diversion. However, we are using one at Nationwide that has been internally validated, so we've been using it for several years, and we're starting to use it with all our patients.
I think my main point of showing you these is to know we don't just kind of do it off the fly or by the seat of our pants. We actually have scales out there, some of that have been validated that we try and use as screening tools. So you are going to use them. You'll learn more about them, know that they're out there, and we'll get you more familiar as time goes on. So thinking about the physical domain, this is probably the one we're all most comfortable with. It's what we're most used to assessing. So what is pain or other symptoms that people have, level of consciousness, cognition, and delirium. We talked a little bit about function, how well are people eating, how about their wounds, and what are they able to do. Okay. And then psychological. So thinking about who is this person? What's their normal behaviors? What's their normal coping? Do they have any kind of mental health issue that we need to be aware of that may impact the decisions that they make? How are they? Are they, I like to call them control freaks, not control freaks? Do they like uncertainty? Do they not like uncertainty? Is there conflict within the family? And how do they think about themselves? What's their self-image? So these are all pieces that are important for us to think about. It's also a place where you're not going to know how to do all of this, and you shouldn't. You need to assess it, but in terms of treating it or helping people manage it, this is what you have your interdisciplinary team for, your social workers, your psychologists. You can't do this all by yourself. And the same goes for all the social pieces. So thinking about cultural values and practices, I think Dr. Ferris mentioned earlier how people make decisions is very much culturally bound. So some folks, they really, independence and autonomy is what's most important. In other cultures, it may be more of a family systems approach to decision making. So knowing those pieces, how isolated is someone? What are the intimacy issues? There's a lot that goes on with intimacy and sexuality for our patients. And I will admit it's probably something we're not so good at addressing and we need to be assessing for it. Finances, we talked about legal pieces, living wills, and then we recently have had some really difficult cases around guardianship and custody issues, so not forgetting those pieces too. Is this all kind of sounding familiar? Okay. I do want to come back just quickly about who is HPOAs, and this is my pet peeve, and so I'm going to stand on my soapbox for a moment. So when you're in a hospital system, I will tell you that, at least in our hospital system, they are not very good at figuring out who the legal next of kin is or who the HPOA is. So just being aware that even if it says it on the chart, it might not be right. And that happened to me again yesterday. I'm telling you, busy day. There was a patient who was found down in the field, was brought in, intubated, and I met his three adult children, and they all said he would never want any of this. And I said, is your mom involved? And she said, no, they've been divorced for years. And thank God I didn't stop there, because if I had, we would have gone full force into comfort care, and you know that would have been that. Turned out he actually's married, so they had a stepmother that they hate, so they never mention her name. And she's the one who's the decision maker. But nowhere in the chart did it say that. So just being careful about making sure you know who the decision makers are for patients who aren't able to speak for themselves. I'm now getting off my soapbox. Okay. And then spirituality. So again, this is a place where, depending on your faith, your practices, your spirituality, you may be very comfortable in this domain, and that's great. For others of you, you may not be. Our hope is that we will teach you how to assess for it. So assessing on how patients make meaning, are they having existential issues, what are their beliefs and practices that are important to them. I do not expect any of you to be able to manage that by yourself. That's where your interdisciplinary team comes in. That's why you have chaplains. But I do expect you to be able to assess for it, and we're going to teach you how to assess for it. Does that make sense? Okay. And then just some very practical things. So, you know, what can they do at home? Can they go home? What does home look like? Who's going to be at home with them? Do they have dependents? How are they going to get to and from appointments? Do they actually have a telephone at home? A few months ago, I had an interesting patient. She was in the Ross, and she'd been there for about a week. And we were trying to figure out goals of care for her, and she really wanted to go home with hospice. And I said, you know, what are you most worried about right now? What's going on? And she said, my dog. I said, what's happening to your dog? Her dog had been at home for a week by itself because she didn't have any family to take care of it. And that was the thing she was most distressed about. For her, that was a tremendous piece of her suffering, that her dog was at home alone. So asking those questions. And then finally, end of life or death management. So lots of different ways that we can help patients and families deal with impending death. Life closure, legacy work, preparing for the unexpected. We talked about, what is death going to look like? What does the dying process look like? What kind of rituals do we need to be ready for? The one caveat is, again, everybody's different. So you'll often hear people wax poetic about legacy work. Legacy work is great. If you have a patient who has young kids and they want to write letters or do videos, that's fabulous. But that's not right for everyone. So just being careful that we're not projecting what we think a good death is, that we're asking patients, what's most important to you as you get prepared for your death? And if that includes legacy work, great. And if it doesn't, that's okay too. And then finally, loss and grief. So you'll get more exposure to this when you're at Kobacker for my folks, and then the Ohio Health folks probably get much more exposure than the Ohio State fellows will, because we don't have a lot of bereavement at Ohio State. We just don't. We don't have a hospice. And usually it's the hospice that does that piece. You need to be thinking about it, though, in terms of every patient that you come across, how are they going to think about loss? How are they going to think about grief? How are they going to deal with bereavement? Have they had a loss before? How did that loss go? How is that loss affecting this potential loss? All of those things come into play, and so needing to assess for it and think about it. So my hope is that these domains are helping you realize, God, there's a lot of things to ask about. You may feel a little overwhelmed by it, and that's okay, because we're really not expecting in one fell swoop that you get through all of them. But over time, in your relationship with a patient and their family, that you work your way through them and you're assessing all of those domains. So normally we would practice. And so what I'm going to ask you to do is a little homework, because I want to be mindful of time. So on the back side of the domain sheet that I gave you tonight, just take a few moments about one patient that you had recently. One patient that had advanced illness, maybe you decided to send them home to hospice, or maybe there was a goals of care question about what was going on. It can be in the ED, can be in the floors, could be at hospice, whatever works for you. Pick one patient and just try and walk your way through all the domains. Find out the ones that you normally ask, because you'll be surprised. You probably ask a lot of these questions. But then I want you to pay close attention to the ones you don't ask. the ones that are just not part of your repertoire normally, because those are the ones that are going to be a little harder for you to get out. So just trying to identify, what's your gap here? What's the pieces you often forget to ask about as you start your fellowship? Okay? So just taking a few moments tonight, if you can, before you all come back tomorrow, to think about, what are the ones that I ask all the time, and what are the ones that I often forget to ask? Do you have something to add?
I just have a longitudinal homework assignment. Okay. For mostly the adult practitioners, would be twofold. When over the course of your year, before you get to us, think about when you're working with some of your younger patients, 30s, high 20s, after you do it, I want you to kind of do some homework and thought about how would I translate that in my month in pediatrics. Secondly, start with a small win. So if you have children, you have nieces, uncles, or nephews, think of loss as, I can't let you have that toy right now, or no, you can't have the cookie, or now I have to ground you, right? It sounds really silly, but if you start actually thinking about that kind of loss for a kid, how you're managing it, how you're feeling about, you know, if it's applicable, how these apply, it'll actually make it easier for you then to start biting off the big chunks when you come over to us, okay? Because loss is all different types for kids.
Okay. And then one more piece. So we are part of this equation. And the teams that you work with are part of this equation too. So we need to assess our care teams. How are they doing with this? Who should be involved? Who is involved? What's their expertise? What's the understanding of illness for them and what the goals of care are? What are the limits of care? I'm going to tell you a story that happened to me. And, you know, I think we all have patients that we remember, right? There's these special patients that just stay with us forever. And this is one of my special patients. So she was a young woman with pretty advanced breast cancer. She had a 3-year-old son, very involved husband and family. And she knew she had a terminal illness, but she was trying to live life to the fullest. And we had talked about goals of care, and she was clear about how she wanted the end to be, and we thought we had this movie totally figured out. And then she went to Disney World for a trip with her son and ended up getting a pneumonia, intubated in Florida, and med-flighted to Ohio State. So I met her in our ICU, and I'd known her for years, and we tried to manage her symptoms. And the team, the ICU team, the pulmonologist said, we're never going to get her off this vent. She has a combination of just one lung is just chock-a-block full of tumor, and she's got ARDS as well. We can't get her off, so we're going to have to palliatively extubate her here. Amazingly, she was awake, and she could write furiously. So we spent a lot of time just sitting at the bedside asking her questions and her husband questions about, hey, this is where we're at. Tell me what's most important. Tell me how we can help you at this time in your life. And what she would say to us through writing is that she hadn't prepared her 3-year-old. She knew it was coming and she was doing all the right things, but she didn't expect it then. Can't we buy her a little more time? The ICU team said, no, we can't. So our job was to say, hey, let's think outside the box. So we trached her. So she went with a trach to an inpatient hospice and lived about a month more. And she could whisper. She was actually able to eat a little bit. Her son would ride his tricycle up and down the hallways. He sat on her bed. They played. And she and her husband had time where they could really talk about what she wanted for her son as he grew. And she knew she wouldn't be there. So part of this is saying your job as the palliative care team is, number one, assess your team, see how they're doing, but also assess how they think about this, because sometimes they're limited in their scope of practice, and it's our job to blow it up, to kind of think about, hey, maybe there's other ways to do this. If we know what's suffering for our patients, can we help address it in some way? And she is a case that will stay with me forever as probably one of my most proud moments that I was able to think outside the box and say, wait, maybe we can do something different. than we've done before. And finally, things change. So you come up with a plan, you think you understand a patient's suffering and their family's suffering, and you think you have a good plan in place, and then something happens. So roll with it. It's all you can do. And keep reassessing. One assessment is never enough because our experience changes every day. And so we just need to keep reassessing and reassessing as we form these relationships with our patients and their families. So I hope as you go forward that your goal, you know your goal is to reduce suffering whenever possible and to assess all aspects of potential suffering for your patients and your families. And know that sometimes we can't do exactly what we would hope to do, but we're going to do our very best for what patients care most about.
Thanks again for tuning in. I hope you'll rate and review this podcast and share it with your colleagues and your friends. So you don't miss any of our new content, make sure you are subscribing to PCIC Podcasts. PCIC is sponsored by PalMed, where our aim is to advance palliative care globally and ensure all clinicians have the latest knowledge and skill. To access more PCIC content, please visit palmed.us to review our extensive open access PCIC curriculum.